Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes. And by Curious.com, with a 10-minute interview followed by daily bite-sized learning recommendations to measure and build people's CQ, or Curious Quotient. Curious.com/the world, where people can learn something new every day.
Where ISIS gets its bomb-making materials, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A new report traces the origins of the components ISIS uses to build IEDs. Most of them come from places you wouldn't suspect.
These are all areas with lots of civilians that need things. They need food, they need supplies to rebuild. And in with that slips in all these materials that end up making IEDs.
Plus the transformation of a pro-democracy activist in Burundi.
He talked about Jeffersonian democracy. He talked about freedom of speech.
Now that man has been sanctioned by the U.S. government. Find out why just ahead. And foodies, listen up. This Iranian food blogger's got a line on the next big thing in fruit.
Quince. Quince is one of them for sure.
Get the scoop coming up today on The World. Thank you for being with us today. All the candidates vying to succeed President Obama want to defeat ISIS. That's a political no-brainer. The key is in the details, of course, as it always is. And we want to start things off today with a closer look at a key detail when it comes to the so-called Islamic State. Where do ISIS extremists in Iraq and Syria get their bomb-making materials? Specifically, their IEDs, or improvised explosive devices. A British investigative group called Conflict Armament Research has been looking into this. James Bevan is the director there, and I asked him first for his definition of an IED.
It's an improvised explosive device, so it's anything that in its entirety is not constructed as a purpose factory-built explosive.
So you specifically looked into ISIS workshops that are used to build these IEDs. What are the key ingredients in, like, one of the ISIS IEDs?
Yeah, just a bit of background first. We've been operational for 20 months. We're embedded with the YPG in Syria, with the Peshmerga in northern Iraq, and with the Shia militia. So every time they overrun an Islamic State workshop, or indeed an Islamic State position, we document whatever weapons, ammunition, and related material are there. So in terms of IED construction, they're actually manufacturing a whole range from truck bombs, car bombs, items used in suicide bombings, to projected weapons. So, for example, improvised mortars, rocket-assisted projectiles, and then things which they use defensively. So more like landmines for area denial and booby traps. So there's a wide range of sophistication in all of those types.
So how is ISIS getting access to the raw materials to supply those workshops?
It depends very much on the component part. So if they're making homemade explosive, then they tend to use things like nitrate fertilizer mixed with other industrial chemicals. In terms of electronics, which are used to initiate the devices, they're using commercially available microcontrollers, common mobile phones, and then more purpose-built explosive stores, things like detonators, detonating cord. They've largely captured them on the battlefield because the Syrian government stockpiled a lot.
So we're talking materials that are actually legal for the most part. How can you even start to stem the supply of these components?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Most of the component parts that we're looking at are legally traded within the civilian market. One issue we have is that some of these are known to be used in the construction of homemade explosives, so nitrate fertilizer, for example. And in Western countries, because this is known, they're quite heavily regulated, so it makes them traceable. This is not the case in the region, where there are a lot of very small-scale distributors, and they clearly do not have adequate records of who they've supplied them to.
Yeah, and if you've got, like, some young guy walking in a store and asking to buy, like, 50 mobile phones, shouldn't that be setting off alarm bells?
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why we put the report together and put it out in the public domain. Part of it is to educate manufacturers, particularly at a local level, that these component parts can be used by Islamic State and other terrorist organizations to construct IEDs. Therefore, you need to be a lot more vigilant. And that's where the awareness needs to be raised.
It kind of reminds me of the benign cold medicines that can be mixed up and cooked to make methamphetamine. I mean, ultimately, drugstores here were told they couldn't sell more than a certain number of packages of cold medicine at a time. Is that a realistic option when you're talking about things like cable and fertilizer and cell phones, all things that are innocuous but can be used to make bombs?
I don't think it's realistic for every component part that we've identified, but certain key component parts or key chemical precursors, that's certainly the case.
James Bevan, Executive Director of Conflict Armament Research there. So as we just heard, the report's authors say the weakest link in the chain is the small entities at the end of the supply chain, the ones who acquire stuff that's useful for bomb making and wittingly or unwittingly sell it to ISIS or its agents. So just what are these small entities? Erica Solomon is Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, and she's done plenty of her own reporting into the ISIS weapon supply routes over the past year. Erica, who does the report have in mind when they talk about these small companies and traders?
Well, what I've come across in my own research, and I've actually spoken with James as well on the reports that he's been working on, is that when you get to the last point before crossing into Syria, a lot of times what I would find on the Turkish border would be that there are these very small-time businessmen who have deals, basically, with ISIS. I don't know if they are sympathizers. Some people are. Some may be doing it purely for business. We found that was actually pretty common in other types of trade, like arms dealing. But one of the cases that we followed in particular was a money exchange office on the Turkish border in a town called Akçakale, which is right across from an area that used to be controlled by ISIS. And basically, this man, you know, ostensibly had an office where he just exchanged money. But actually, what he was also doing, we found out from interviewing his employees, was taking in large sums of cash. And then his employees found out that he was then going and buying large quantities of fertilizer and aluminum poles and metal and that kind of thing, which are basic elements of the IEDs that the CAR report talks about at length. And so our sense was that basically there you have all types of these little tiny businesses, you would never notice them doing this kind of very small trade, and it just the flow is constant.
Are any of them kind of concerned that maybe what they're doing is helping out ISIS, or is it profitable to such a degree that they don't care?
Well, I don't know. I mean, none of the people that I spoke to who I would say were probably in the category of unintentional allies would say that it was just, you know, self-interest. They would say, well, we were just providing goods that civilians needed. Mm. And in fact, I don't even think they would be aware of the types of reports that we're reading. I think they do have a sense that there are shady things that happen because, well, you can just tell by the way they talk about it. They're reluctant to sort of go into detail sometimes. They're sometimes suspicious of journalists. And they put it off as fear. You know, I'm afraid. So it's sometimes hard for me to penetrate whether or not that is because they themselves kind of sense that they are part of something that's murky, or if they're genuinely afraid of having accusations pinned on them that they think are unfair.
To the casual observer, this trade may seem immoral, but is it illegal? I mean, is there anything authorities in Lebanon or Turkey can do about this?
First of all, I think that they probably know some of this is happening. I mean, one of the things that I think is that there are certain items in particular that should be traceable. Things like detonators, which is mentioned as well in the CAR report, and fertilizer, I think at this point as well, should raise question marks. I mean, why are more and more people buying mining detonators and that kind of a thing in Turkey or Lebanon? You know, I think that there's justification at this point, given the situation in the region, to go to those companies and ask, do you know who your clients are? Do you know why suddenly they ask for twice the amount or you have twice the number of clients that you did compared to 2 or 3 months ago? I think that those are types of checks that are something you could put into place. Where it becomes more problematic is when you talk about things like phones and concrete, metal, things that just justifiably have a purpose in any place in the world, including places where people are at war and are still trying to live their lives. So I think there's limited amount of regulation that you can impose there, as well as the fact that basically ISIS can find ways to make weapons out of so many things.
So as long as ISIS has enough money, Erica, this trade in bomb-making supplies is just going to continue, you think?
Yes, I think it will. I think they will find a way.
Erica Solomon, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, speaking with me from Beirut. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's hard to believe we're about to mark the fifth anniversary of the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown at Japan's Fukushima power plant. Today, a strange footnote to that meltdown. The operator of the power plant, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has apologized for not announcing sooner that its nuclear reactors were in meltdown. We apologize for the great inconvenience and worry, a TEPCO spokesman said. In 2011, the utility waited 2 months before calling the meltdown a meltdown. TEPCO said the mistake was due to misreading the manual on what constitutes a meltdown. Reporter Naomi Gingold has more from Washington. What exactly has TEPCO admitted, Naomi?
So in going back over their procedures, they said they found a manual that had regulations, that had they followed those regulations, they would have realized they were in meltdown.
I mean, that's a little hard to believe, because what I read is that apparently 5% of the rods, if they're compromised, that's a meltdown. But Fukushima, just days after this catastrophe, they were at 55% compromised rods, and they still said it wasn't a meltdown. I mean,
you know, I think TEPCO was in denial to itself at the time and, of course, to the public. One of the plants they want to restart is up in the northern part of Japan, and a governor who objected to the plan actually asked them to go over everything that had happened at Fukushima again before he would consider restarting the plants. And supposedly it was in going over that information that TEPCO found that they had these regulations that they hadn't followed.
If that's their explanation, are there people who are saying, of course they knew, they just didn't want to panic the Japanese public just days after one of the worst disasters Japan's ever seen?
You know, absolutely there are people that say that. And that's the truth. After the disaster, they deliberately held back on information, both TEPCO and the government, because they supposedly did not want to panic the population. But at the same time, people were panicking because they didn't have information. And people don't trust TEPCO to this day. People don't trust the Japanese government to this day when it comes to information about Fukushima, especially. I think there have been some changes at TEPCO, and especially talking to the chief nuclear officer here yesterday, who said to me, and I took him at face value, that he said he really thinks that the culture started to change over the last year, that this was an honest attempt to admit a mistake that at least the people who now saw the mistake wanted to admit.
Did the delay in declaring the meltdown at Fukushima, is there any evidence that that had any effect on the response to the disaster?
I don't think that that's the case. I mean, you know, this information is just out a couple days ago. I think people are still kind of assessing it. I think it more is another blow to the trust that people had in TEPCO. I don't think anyone is saying so far that it would have changed how people handled the disaster.
So I gather TEPCO officials are in Washington, D.C. today. Tell us what they're doing there.
So yesterday there was an event in D.C. put on by the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is this organization that promotes the use of nuclear energy. And it was a panel about Fukushima Daiichi 5 years later. It was supposed to be a progress report. I think it was really an attempt to kind of trot out the positive side and show the progress that has been made.
Mm. So right after the meltdown on March 11th, 2011, there was a real pushback against nuclear power in Japan. I think like all the country's reactors were taken offline. How many are back online, and is Fukushima back up and running, any of its reactors?
Currently, Marco, two reactors have been restarted. There's a third reactor that is slated to be restarted, and the process was started this month. They found a leak at that reactor. But they've said it was just from a loose bolt, and that leak is not stopping them from turning the reactor back on starting tomorrow, actually. So TEPCO, of course, is pushing for more reactors to be online. Yesterday at this event, they were, in fact, promoting one in particular that they want to put back online, which is the largest nuclear facility in the world. And they were promoting all the new safety features there. But Fukushima itself is definitely far from ever going back online. The cleanup process there is huge and ongoing.
Reporter Naomi Gingold speaking with me from Washington about the Japanese power utility TEPCO. Thanks very much, Naomi.
Thanks so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Tonight, it's the latest battle of rhetoric between the Republican presidential candidates. It'll be their last debate before Tuesday's big primary vote. So let's take a moment to look at what the candidates, and not just the Republicans, are saying about the Mideast. After all, it is one of the key challenges facing the next president. I have friend of the show Kim Gattas on the line to help us out. Kim's covered the Middle East as well as the U.S. presidential elections for our partners at the BBC. It is kind of hard to hear substance during an election campaign, Kim. But what's your take so far of how the candidates are speaking out about the Middle East and the kind of policies they'll have once in office?
Well, I haven't heard many details in terms of the policy. As you mentioned, it is hard to get into a lot of substance when you're on the campaign trail, speaking to voters who may not know all the ins and outs of the Middle East or other foreign policy issues. But I must say that I think that most of the candidates don't quite understand the ins and outs of the issues that are at stake right now either. They expectedly speak in bumper sticker sound bites. We've had Ted Cruz say things like, "We're going to carpet bomb ISIS and find out if the sand glows in the dark." So it is worrying for people in the Middle East.
You know, some might argue that presidents can't be experts in everything, and that's why they have advisors to help them shape policies. Would you agree with that when it comes to the Mideast?
Oh, absolutely. I think no presidential candidate, no president even, can be a full-on expert on all the regions that they need to cover as a candidate. That's why they do surround themselves with advisors. I haven't seen many advisors around Ben Carson or Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. He's only just now signed up a foreign policy advisor. I understand that the economy is the key concern of voters in the U.S., but the threat of the so-called Islamic State is also on a lot of people's minds. And it's important to know enough about how to tackle this issue that you don't overplay the threat that it poses to the United States itself, the homeland, and that you don't stoke people's fears while at the same time not downplaying it, which is something that President Obama has occasionally done. And also, I think it is important to have a good grasp of what is happening around the world for a presidential candidate, because in the end, foreign policy and the economy merge in so many ways. If the world is in upheaval, it has an impact on the U.S. economy as well.
Kim, what are you hearing from your friends and family and colleagues who are watching this election from inside the region?
There's a lot of eye rolling. There's a lot of anxiety. There is bewilderment. People in the Middle East don't really understand the phenomena of Donald Trump. I've spoken to Arab officials, Gulf officials, who are asking me, you know, what is going on? What does it mean? What is going to happen? But I think that at the end of the day, they are hoping that things will stabilize.
I'm curious, what do you tell those Arab officials who ask you, what is going on over there in the U.S.?
Well, I ask them, what the hell is going on in the Middle East? Because, you know, this is a year where there is a lot of upheaval, a lot of, you know, sweeping statements and being made by parties everywhere. Unfortunately, in the Middle East, it comes with a lot of bloodshed as well.
My colleague with the BBC, Kim Gattas, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's something about the Mideast I think we can all agree on. The food totally rocks. And though you may be thinking falafel and hummus and baklava, the food is so different from country to country, as I found on my recent trip to Iran. Great kebabs, obviously, but also the simple joys of fresh oven-baked bread or a sweet cup of tea. Food can make for powerful nostalgia, and that's the case with this Iranian-American. She visited Tehran last year and decided not to leave.
I did want to explore the possibility of coming back to Iran, not as a tourist or a visitor, not to be like the khariji, which means foreigner, and they tell me like I speak with an accent and all of that, but to come back and really reclaim my roots and just be an Iranian as well.
Azita Hushyar used to practice law in New York City, but for the last 6 months or so, she's been living in Iran, writing about food. We sat down earlier this month at a tea house in downtown Tehran to talk about one of my favorite subjects.
So the blog, the Instagram feed is called Fig and Quince.
Is
that a reference to certain nostalgic moments that you've had over the years?
I did want to name it Naranj and Toranj, which is the name of one of my favorite fairy tales. But that translates to orange and bergamot, which I couldn't even smell the bergamot. So Fig and Quince, those are both fruits that are actually, they do have roots in Iranian culture as well. Like, people love them. Pomegranate, you know, by now is too cliche. Yeah.
So as long as we're talking about fruit, let's talk about one thing that I've noticed in Iranian cuisine, and that is the use of fruit with savory dishes,
yes,
especially meats.
Yes.
What's going on there?
Part of it traces its roots to the royal cuisine. Like, I've heard that simple everyday fare in Iran didn't necessarily do that, but in the courts of imperial courts of, like, let's say Shah Abbas or the Qajar Shahs, to make it special, and then, like, they trickle down to, you know, the food of everyday people. They're definitely also associated with ceremonial food as well, like festive occasions for our Nowruz or for weddings. There's this thing we make, which is called Javahar Polo, which literally means jeweled rice, and we use all sorts of beautiful things in it, from berberries and slivered pistachios, slivered almonds, really thinly sliced orange peels, and it's just exquisite. It's wonderful, and it looks beautiful too.
So you say it's a celebratory thing, but we went to this very kind of everyday cafeteria, Khoni, and it was like meats with all sorts.
Yeah.
What were some of the kind of fruits that you've encountered in just everyday cooking?
Well, quince. Quince is one of them for sure, which one of my predictions is that quince is going to be the next breakout fruit, like probably surpassing pomegranate. Although turnip could make a showing there as well. I feel like turnip is very much understated, and it's big here. Oh, we do. Like, we use it for its healing properties, but we also use it in soups, and it's definitely one of those things that any mom worth their salt, like the second that you start coughing, they whip out the turnip and they boil it for you and they serve it to you. But people do eat it actually as a nice snack. But yeah, we definitely do use a lot of fruits. We also use flowers in our cooking.
What kind of flowers?
Well, all sorts of flowers. The standard, the very much the stereotype one, is the Gule Mohammadi, which is a rose, and it's beautiful pink, and you dry it, and then you grind it so that it becomes a powder, and you use that powder to garnish a bowl of, like, yogurt with cucumber, mastokhiyar. We use cardamom a lot. Like, saffron, again, when you think of Iran, I think most people would, even if they have a superficial understanding, if they think saffron, they think kebab, they think rice, which definitely all of those are applicable.
Not inaccurate.
No, they're not inaccurate, and they're definitely applicable. Mm. But for example, in my family, the spice that we rave about, and my sister talks about it with absolute nostalgia, is cardamom. We use that in our traditional ice cream, bastaniye sonati, and my sister hasn't been back yet. And she definitely, when she talks about it, she kind of like almost has an out-of-body experience with just like the memory of it.
Out-of-body experience is right. I had one just eating my pound bag of Iranian pistachios, and now they're all gone. To hear more of my conversation with Azita Hushyar, go to PRI.org. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Abortion is illegal in Ireland, and yet
abortion is a reality of Irish life. It just doesn't happen in Ireland.
A new project invites Irish women who've traveled abroad to get an abortion to come forward and have their pictures taken. Destigmatizing abortion in Ireland, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Even in the midst of the most inhumane conflicts, sometimes you can find people who seem to rise above the fray and offer hope. That's what many people saw in a journalist from the Central African nation of Burundi named Alexis Sinduhije a decade or two ago.
He talked about Jeffersonian democracy. He talked about freedom of speech. And he was really famous for getting Hutus who'd killed Tutsis and Tutsis who'd killed Hutus on air, on the radio, confessing their crimes and expressing remorse.
That's Farah Stockman, a columnist and editorial writer at the Boston Globe. She recently wrote about Sinduhije. Stockman says when she met him more than a decade ago, his commitment to nonviolent ideals seemed unshakable.
he really talked about journalism as reconciliation and had these big dreams for his country. And he'd spent time at Harvard. It really opened his eyes to the Western world. And he was just this master communicator with an incredible Rolodex and really a compelling person.
I mean, extraordinary that he was talking Jeffersonian democracy in Burundi, but even more so that he'd get Hutus and Tutsis on air and kind of confess remorse, as you say. And what kind of position did that create for him in Burundian society?
I think he was unique. I think he's loved by both Hutus and Tutsis, at least he was then. And people started to really trust the radio in a way that they didn't before.
The other thing about Alexis is that he had this incredible credibility in international circles. He had friends in high places. He won a Shorenstein Fellowship to Harvard, became friends with now UN Ambassador Samantha Power, who was then running the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard's Kennedy School. What did Samantha Power do to help Alexis specifically?
She served on the board of his radio station. She helped him get funding for it. There were some independent radios in Burundi at that time, but none that would do the sort of investigative reporting that Alexis was known for.
Your story about Alexis starts to take a really weird turn when he moves out of journalism, forms a political party. He ran for president of Burundi, and in recent years seems to have gone through such a political evolution that last December he was sanctioned by the U.S. government for supporting armed rebellion in Burundi, even planning to assassinate senior officials in Burundi. What is the evidence to support all that?
That's what I was trying to figure out. When he ran for president, he ended up boycotting the election because he felt like they were stealing it. They arrested him. And, you know, shortly after the boycott, he goes into exile. There's a lot of evidence that his members were being killed, and some of them took up arms. And he says, look, I'm not part of the armed rebellion, but I morally support it.
This was the U.S. government, though, that brought up these charges against him.
Yes.
They sanctioned him. I mean, aren't they supposed to show us the proof that there's reason to sanction somebody like this?
Well, no. He's going through a legal process right now to ask for the unclassified version of the evidence against him. And we'll see. I couldn't get anything out of them except people off the record told me, look, if you're going to write an article about how he's not involved in armed rebellion, you're going to be wrong.
Do you think they've got the goods?
It's possible that they are trying to show balance. They didn't just sanction Alexis. They sanctioned people associated with the current government. They sanctioned a pro-government militia that's been killing people. So I think they're trying to show that they're a balanced broker here.
So what is your big conclusion from all this? I gather you're still kind of trying to figure out, but who do you think Alexis Sindehije is today? This former journalist who was bent on speaking truth to power, could he also be the same person who's behind a string of recent assassinations in Burundi?
And what do you take away if he's both?
Right.
What do you take away from that if he's both? It reminded me a lot of Syria and how you have peaceful democratic activists who are peacefully advocating for change. Government cracks down on them. And then they really see no choice but to take up arms because they have to defend themselves. They don't want to die. And
maybe that's the overall general narrative takeaway here is that, you know, a promising young man in a country that's troubled goes off the rails.
That was something I really struggled with, and I think some people in the U.S. government at very high levels are struggling with. What's the role of violence when it comes to bringing progressive values? Because the American Revolution was violent. We killed people, and we wouldn't have been able to get our independence without it. These days, we have this idea that because of the civil rights movement and Gandhi, and we have this idea that nonviolence is the only way to bring progressive values forward, and it's the only way to go. But in some countries, that's just not possible. So I really struggled with that.
Farah Stockman is a columnist and editorial writer at the Boston Globe. Her story in the Globe is headlined, "An Icon of Peace in Burundi Turns to War." Thank you very much for coming in.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Alexis Sindehije currently lives in Paris, and that's where we reached him earlier. He says the U.S. sanctions against him are unfair.
I still feel that human dignity is something very important, and that this is what I've learned at Harvard University, and that's what I'm fighting for. In Burundi, we have a terrorist on the head of the state. We have this man who is killing 150 people a day. And that person is not someone who understands that we can build a country on debate based on ideas. So I am very, very in dilemma. What can I tell to those youth who had taken the weapons to defend themselves. Am I going to tell them to stop? I don't have the answer. I'm still against violence, but sometimes I am pushed by those youth. I have lots of affection for Samantha Power, but has she achieved much? I don't think so. I really don't think so. If I will have stayed in front of her and look at her in the eyes, I will say, you shake the hand of the killers, of the evil.
Former Burundian journalist Alexei Sindahije, he's been sanctioned by the U.S. government for supporting armed rebellion and planning to assassinate senior Burundian officials. In Ireland tomorrow, there's an election, and among the issues that could be affected by the outcome is abortion. The procedure is illegal in Ireland. Irish voters made it so back in 1983 when they approved the Eighth Amendment to the country's constitution. The question now is whether the next government in Dublin puts the issue up for a vote again. Thousands of Irish women travel abroad each year, mostly to the UK, to terminate their pregnancies. Many say they can't really speak publicly about that experience back home in Ireland. A new website called the Exile Project invites those women to come forward and have their portraits taken. Julie Morrissey helped found the site. She says the goal is to start a conversation about a subject many prefer to ignore in Ireland.
What we're trying to show is that abortion is a reality of Irish life. It just doesn't happen in Ireland. So we wanted to make sure that we were presenting the reality of Irish abortion by showing the faces of ordinary women who have had abortions in the UK or elsewhere.
So with women telling their stories or kind of facing the camera, as it were, what are kind of the common threads that wind through their stories?
It's almost the ordinariness of abortion. So I suppose the common thread is really that there are women in various circumstances and for various reasons who decide to make this choice and to travel to the UK or elsewhere. And really that these women then continue on with their lives. They're adult women who are able to make decisions about the course of their own lives.
And talk about the word exile, because it's spelled X, letter X, dash, I-L-E. I mean, what does that signify? That, first of all, I guess that they're exiles if they are getting these abortions outside of Ireland, right?
Sure. Effectively, we see women as being exiled from Ireland for abortion services because they're being sent away by the Irish government and a blind eye turned completely to their medical needs. But also it's a reference to the X case, which is a case from the 1980s in Ireland. It was a constitutional case taken about the right to travel, where a young girl who had been raped wanted to leave the country to have an abortion. And there was a constitutional case around this, whether she would be allowed to travel in order to have an abortion, whether that was legal or not. And it was ruled that she was allowed to travel, but the X case wasn't legislated for decades. Mm. It was a judgment that was made in the courts, but it was never put on the law books in Ireland until recently.
So kind of a double meaning there with exile.
Exactly.
The abortion issue in Ireland, like here in the U.S., it can be very polarizing. It can divide whole families, in fact. Mm-hmm. What kind of impact would you like to see the Exile Project have on that divide?
Well, I mean, in larger terms, we want the repeal of the Eighth Amendment. That's our ultimate goal. But in terms of that divide, we're a grassroots organization. We want to open up conversation about abortion between ordinary people on an everyday level. You know, the abortion conversation here is very much controlled from a top-down basis. We have politicians and government who refuse to discuss this issue. They refuse to discuss the issue in the context of the upcoming election, and they generally refuse to have conversations around women's abortion experiences. And we don't think that's acceptable. I mean, whereas maybe the stigma before was coming from the Catholic Church, and that is still an element, certainly. But we now have a situation where the leaders of this country will not speak about an experience that has affected over 160,000 Irish women. So we want to open up that conversation. We want people to confront abortion experiences and talk about them, and for it not to be a taboo in daily life, for women to be able to speak about this experience of having been sent away for a medical procedure.
Now, last May, a referendum was passed in Ireland legalizing gay marriage, and it would also take a national referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment banning abortion. How much hope do you have of the abortion issue actually coming to a national vote?
I think that it will come to a national vote, and I think that's imminent. The polls are showing that there is support for a referendum on the Eighth Amendment. And many of the political parties here have taken a pledge to make abortion or what we're calling a red line issue, which would mean that they would commit to holding a referendum on the Eighth Amendment in the early lifetime of their government. So that's really the concentration here at the moment is the election on Friday, getting people out to vote a responsible government that will ensure that this there's a vote on this issue and in the near future, in 2016, hopefully.
Irish poet and activist Julie Morrissey, who helped found the site The Exile Project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You can see some of the women who've come forward to be photographed for The Exile Project at PRI.org. If you turned on the tap in Delhi this week, you'd be out of luck. A group of angry protesters cut off the main water to supply India's capital for days. In some areas, it's still not back. The people blocking roads and sabotaging the water supply were from the Jat caste. It's a relatively well-off group, but the thing is, they want the government to classify them as a backward caste. We called up Mumbai-based reporter Chavi Sachdev to explain. Who exactly are the people in the Jat caste, Chavi?
Well, the Jats are an ancient military community. They've also been royalty. They belong to the state of Haryana and Rajasthan. And they're pretty well off. They're landowners.
So if the Brahmins are kind of at the top of the caste social order, where do the Jats fit in?
The Jats are definitely on the higher end of the caste strata.
All right. So why would they then want to be kind of downsized, classified as backwards?
Well, being backward in this country actually comes with some perks. You get a quota, a reservation for jobs in the government that have been set aside. You still have to compete for them, but it's a smaller quorum and you have fewer people to fight off. So within government jobs, positions at the universities, as students as well as teachers, you have a preference.
And the Jats on their own kind of like stature can't get these jobs?
Well, they can, but they'd be competing with everybody else. While if they have a quota, they suddenly have a smaller pool to compete with.
Yeah, so that caste quota idea, does this mean with the Jats wanting to be kind of downgraded as a backward caste, does this mean that India's form of affirmative action has essentially failed?
I think you could say that because, as you can see in Delhi, an entire nation is being held hostage to a group that wants privileges. And we're having to concede them. They're in this position because they were promised this by the former government of the state. And when the current government challenged it, the Supreme Court backed them up to say that this group does not qualify for these kind of provisions and privileges. They got really agitated and they think they're entitled to this kind of privilege.
How cushy are those government jobs that those lower castes are entitled to?
What's attractive is the fringe benefits. You get housing, you get transport for free. You don't really have to do a lot. There's some scope for bribery, and your children are taken care of. It's also secure for life. You can't be fired from one.
Do you know anyone, Chavi, who's gotten a job or university seat this way?
Actually, I do. These are people who went to high school with me, and given that they were in school with me and they could afford it, they certainly could afford to pay their own tuition and go to a decent school. But they used the caste card and got into pretty nice colleges where their grades wouldn't have gotten them in.
From the outside, it looks kind of ludicrous. Are the Jats getting any support?
They're getting support within their own community. But in the rest of the country, people are angry. And the whole reservation debate has been kicked up again. In fact, there are a whole lot of jokes going around.
You mean the quota system idea?
About the quota system, yeah. So one of the jokes going around is Barack Obama meets Narendra Modi, and Obama says, oh, we're sending 23 astronauts to space next year. And Modi says, oh, we're sending 100. We've got 35 other backward castes, 27 scheduled castes, 18 tribals, 10 women, 9 from the sports quota. And one astronaut.
I got to check the math on that. has there ever been, Chavi, a caste that has wanted to be downgraded in social standing? This must be pretty rare.
Yes, this has happened many times before. People agitate to be labeled as backward.
Chavi Sachdev, who is a reporter based in Mumbai. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco. Pleasure.
A Brazilian composer gets animated. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The long fight over a dam project in northern Brazil is pretty much over. After a quarter century of plans and protests and construction and more protests, the Belo Monte Dam Complex, on a tributary of the Amazon River, will start generating power next month. It'll be the third largest hydroelectric project in the world. But even as the lakes behind the dams fill up, the protests, often led by women activists, have not stopped. As part of our Across Women's Lives coverage in Brazil this week, The World's Carolyn Beeler has our story.
25
years. That's how long Antonia Mello says she's been fighting against the Belo Monte Dam complex on the Xingu River. Since then, the project has been canceled, restarted, and pared down. But even after construction finally began in 2011, Mello and her group Xingu Alive Forever didn't give up. This project is a project of destruction and death of the environment, she says. Forests have been cleared, a river has been rerouted, and people have been moved. Mello lives in the city of Altamira, just west of the three-dam Belo Monte complex. She and 2,000 neighbors used to live here, on the edge of the city, near the banks of the Xingu.
Aqui era sala.
Mello points to a spot of red Amazon mud where her living room used to be. It's now part of a construction site.
E a partir daquelas plantas ali,
where those plants are there, that's where my backyard was, she says. Her house was flattened last fall to make way for a park, one of the amenities the dam building company agreed to during its long, contentious licensing process. Mello is one of an estimated 30,000 people who've been displaced. Some of them have moved from flood-prone homes to sturdy new ones. But Mello refuses to see any good in the dam coming to town. I continue firmly against the hydroelectric complex of Belo Monte, she says. Mello's brash style of activism was bred during Brazil's military dictatorship in the 70s and 80s. But others have abandoned the no-compromise approach in favor of a more pragmatic one as the dam has become a reality. Mello drove with me down the Trans-Amazonian Highway from the city to meet one of them. A group of indigenous women and children are camped out in some buses that they've commandeered from the dam company. That's Bel Giruna, a young and more measured leader of the Moratu village. She says the workers' buses were taken as a bargaining chip. Giruna is no longer fighting the dam, but she is trying to win a smaller victory, get the company to keep its promises to indigenous communities. We wanted them to create income and projects so we can survive and keep our people where we are, she says. If not, we'll have to leave. They'd have to leave because they've always fished to survive, but the dams are changing all that. Lots of fish have died, Giruna says. This has been very difficult for us. The only profession here was fishing, and now that's impossible, Giruna says. She herself has found a job as a health worker, but others haven't been so fortunate. The company that's building the dam complex, Norte Energia, wouldn't talk for this report. It has made good on some of its promises, but it also has a history of unmet obligations. The Giruna people say they're still owed healthcare, educational facilities, and protections from encroachment on their land. In response to these concerns, regulators seem to be learning some lessons.
Eles nos trazem algumas percepções.
Rodrigo Erlis is with Brazil's environmental agency. He says it's not enough to look only at technical reports and studies in evaluating the impacts of projects like this. We need more local insight. Erlis says hydroelectric projects are much less aggressive now than they used to be, and there's more oversight. But he's clear that Brazil needs Belo Monte.
Brazil é país que depende muito da energia.
Brazil is a country that depends a lot on hydroelectric energy, Erlis says. It's also a low-carbon energy source in a time when climate change threatens Brazil as much as anywhere. Antonia Mello says she's still fighting to stop Belo Monte, but she's also looking ahead, working with leaders fighting other dams. It's not just Belo Monte, Mello says. We continue our fight for this type of project to be canceled all over the planet. It's the same uncompromising attitude as 25 years ago, but the legacy of activism against Belamonte may yet be felt in fewer and less damaging hydropower projects elsewhere. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Altamira, Brazil.
And more Brazil this Sunday, when they'll be represented at the Academy Awards. The film Boy and the World is up for an Oscar as Best Animated Feature. It was directed by Ale Abreu, and there are two artistic elements that make his film unique. First, almost no dialogue. And what dialogue there is, it's in Portuguese, spoken backwards. I can't even get my head around that one. But really, it doesn't matter, because this is a story told more through music than with words.
I think it was a huge opportunity, I mean, to take it just to a whole lyrical, a whole poetic dimension by using music as a main form of telling the story.
That's Ruben Pfeffer, music director and one of the film's composers. So, yeah, it's the images and music that tell the story. Boy and the World is about a boy who goes on a journey to find his dad after the father leaves the family to find work. It's a tough journey into a sometimes cruel world, and it's portrayed with a touch of what some critics have called magical realism, even in the soundtrack.
The music gives it a naive character. For instance, we see war tanks at some images, but the war tanks, they look like elephants and other animals. The machine guns, when portrayed, they look like percussion instruments. So everything is taken to a poetic or dreamlike view, always very imaginative, always like the child sees the world.
There's an underlying political subtext. Think globalization, poverty, police brutality, even migrant workers in a cotton field. We are not in Pixar land anymore.
It's a very non-American film, if you come to think of it. And the U.S. is seemingly open to this kind of expression. So this fills me with joy to see the possibility of different styles of artistic expression being out there, you know?
And there are different styles of music in the film, too. It ends with a tune by Brazilian rapper Emicida.
He watched the movie, and a couple of days later, he came back with an idea that was basically that rap song, and we all found it was perfect to end the movie. It would give an impact and bring you back to reality, like in a flash, you know?
Brazilian rapper Emicida from the soundtrack to Boy and the World, which is Brazil shot at an Oscar this weekend in the Best Animated Feature category. Perfect end for us today as well. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow. Sono tipo slow, bro. Onde vou, vou, leio, vou, vou. Até esqueço quem sou, sou. Calçada, barracos e o bonde. A voz ecoa sóis, mas ninguém responde. Miséria, soa como pilhéria. Pra quem tem a barriga cheia, piada séria. Fadiga pra nós, pra eles férias. Morre esperança, e tudo isso aos olhos de uma criança. Gente, carro, vento, arma, roupa. Posso, aos olhos de uma criança. Gente, barro, tempo, karma, boca. Nós, aos olhos de uma criança. Gente, sarro, alento. PRI, Public Radio International.